You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I am your host, Erin O'Sullivan. Today we'll be talking with Jenny Brown of the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary in upstate New York. Jenny and her husband Doug founded the sanctuary about 7 years ago. We're going to be talking to her about how she went from a Louisville, Kentucky city slicker to the operator of an incredibly successful and fast-growing farm animal sanctuary. We'll also be talking about Jenny's new book, which was released in early August. It's called The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals. The book is a combination of autobiography, exposé of animal agriculture, and guide to vegan living, and it is a wonderful read. The story is really amazing, and it's told in such a candid, touching, and unpretentious, and often hilarious way that I think animal defenders everywhere are going to finish the book feeling like they found a new best friend in Jenny Brown. Now, this is the second installment of Erin and Neil's Northeastern United States Road Trip series. A couple of weeks ago, we were in Syracuse, New York, talking to Chris and John of the Vegan Zombie. That interview is now available for download on our website at animalvoices.ca. Right now, we are at The Guest House, which is the bed and breakfast that the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary opened last year. We stayed overnight here. We had an amazing time last night doing a bit of volunteering. We just finished our awesome vegan breakfast, which of course was included as part of the bed and breakfast experience. And now we are about to head up to the main house to meet Jenny. So stay tuned and we will catch you there. Okay, so here we are in the lovely home of Jenny Brown and Doug Abel on the grounds of the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary. Welcome to Animal Voices, Jenny, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys for coming out and for having me on.
So I'm going to ask you all kinds of questions about your life and how you got here and also about your new book. But I guess the first thing to do is to ask you to describe the sanctuary as it exists at present. So in a nutshell, what is the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary?
The Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary is a charitable organization, and we take in farm animals in need, farm animals that have escaped from slaughterhouse trucks, been found around New York City, that are seized from hoarding cases, that sort of thing. And we really focus on food production animals. We're a 23-acre sanctuary with approximately 200 animals at any given time. We provide lifelong shelter to many of them. We provide health care and meet all their medical needs and give them the life that each and every one of them deserves.
Now, I'm going to ask you to step back a little ways and sort of walk us through the journey of how you got here. So just basic stuff like where you grew up and how and why you became interested in the plight of farm animals.
Well, I was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, and lived there until the time I was 21, I think. But right when I started college, I was beginning to look into animals that are used for fur, animals that are used in circuses and for entertainment, used in medical and cosmetic testing, and finally, basically, you know, how we treat the animals we eat and what the lives are like for those animals in this day and age of industrial animal agriculture. So I became vegetarian at 18. I left and moved to Chicago, and there I got involved with an animal advocacy organization and did some undercover video, not in factory farms or slaughterhouses, but just various assignments. Not to obtain a job there, but to try to get in any way possible to get video of, one example is inside of a horse factory farm where they're making the drug Premarin up close to Canada. Actually, the drug maker's in Manitoba, but this was in North Dakota. So that was my initial undercover video work. And it wasn't until about 8 years later that I went undercover. It was in 2002, and I went undercover for another animal advocacy group. And this was all done as a volunteer and outside of my freelance film and television work. But when I went undercover in 2002, I was sent to Texas to visit stockyards to document downed animals. And those are those animals that are too weak or sick to stand, that are non-ambulatory. And the way that they're treated to get them onto the trucks and into the slaughterhouse alive, because dead animals can't arrive at the slaughterhouse, the way they're treated is barbaric. And they suffer and linger sometimes for days. And this footage was going to congressional hearings to try to pass the Downed Animal Protection Act, assuring that these sick and broken animals receive not veterinary treatment, but at least a humane euthanasia. So what I saw that week really changed my life. I just feel like I saw the worst of humankind. Animals, no regard for their welfare, just treated as commodities. And that week in Texas, by myself, traveling from stockyard to stockyard, is what really did it for me. I went on to do the biggest job of my career, produced and directed a show for Discovery Channel, left it all and packed my bags and went to work for another animal sanctuary to really understand what I wanted to get myself involved in. Not only did I want to be a part of rescuing the individuals that need help, but also to be a voice for farm animals everywhere. And because we're so disconnected as a society from the animals that we only know as food, I wanted to bridge that gap. I think sanctuaries have a really unique opportunity of putting people face to face with animals they only know as food, and to treat them and see how they thrive in an environment of love and respect, and to meet them with a name, see them as an individual, and learn how millions of others like them are living at that very moment in miserable confinement and often in terror at the slaughterhouses.
So when you gave it all up and went to work at the farm animal sanctuary, that was Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, right?
Right.
Did you already have it in mind that you wanted to open your own sanctuary and you went to there as a learning experience, or?
I went there, it was a little fantasy in the back of my mind, and it was called, they do it annually, now it's called the Animal Care Conference, but basically they do it once a year. It's a weekend where if you've ever been interested in starting a sanctuary and really getting hands-on in animal rescue, this is your weekend to really learn what's involved. I had gone in, again, with this little fantasy in the back of my mind that perhaps this would be something I would do in the future, or at least buy enough property to where I could have rescued farm animals and to be a home for some and give them lifelong care and love. But after the magic hit me at Farm Sanctuary and I realized what an amazing opportunity it is to open hearts and minds, I love all animals, and that extends to all animals, including those that are used for food, as I feel like we all should. And that weekend really opened my eyes to the plight of farm animals everywhere, and to really want to be a part of the sea change in raising awareness and public consciousness of how these animals live. And it just became, it became an obsessive passion for me, wanting to emulate what they were doing and feeling like, wow, these sanctuaries belong in every community to help bridge that gap in consciousness.
What you just said is a nice segue into my next question, which is the big question on the mind of all of the struggling animal sanctuaries out there. How did you get so big and so strong so fast?
Well, I think it was my year-long experience working at Farm Sanctuary. I took copious notes. I learned all I could about really proper animal care. I studied the buildings, the water systems, who gets heat at night. And when we bought this property in 2004, you know, we're not wealthy people. I think the initial $6,000 came out of our pocket. But the sanctuary is run entirely off donations through a lot of, you know, events down in New York City. We're fortunate to be close to New York City, 2 hours north and on the bus line. We have fun events. We've had concerts. We've been lucky enough to have had some big names like Chrissy Hynde and Moby perform concerts here. Our first fundraiser was our wedding in what is now the cow pasture out there. So innovative and creative thinking, engaging the public in terms of raising awareness, of course, about what we're doing, the good and important work of farm animal sanctuaries. And for us, we chose a community where we get lots of people through our doors. That was intentional. You know, farm sanctuary can survive out in the Finger Lakes region of New York because they're the oldest and the biggest farm animal sanctuary, and it's sort of like a trip to Mecca for many people. Whereas for the rest of us, starting a sanctuary in remote areas where you're not going to get a lot of traffic through your doors, A, you're missing the opportunity to speak on behalf of farm animals everywhere, and B, you're not engaging your community and getting people to come through your doors, meet the animals, leave with an experience that potentially is a life changer. And that was the strategic plan that we had. Woodstock, New York already has its own tourism. It's the hippy-dippy town of peace and love, progressive, forward-thinking. It's not always the case, we found out, with the local politics. But we wanted to be, not only was Doug continuing to work as a film editor and going back and forth to New York City, but I'm very passionate about this cause, and I think it people see that and realize it. And I'm shameless in asking for money. We've landed a couple of big-ish donors. We still don't have a year's operating budget in the bank to fall back on. That's a goal. But we just really work hard in, you know, having fun events and fundraisers. You know, we just had a rooftop party in New York City. We have a Blessing of the Animals coming up and our big annual Thanksgiving event where we seat 250 people in a heated tent in the goat pasture and serve them a really gourmet vegan Thanksgiving style meal. But the turkeys are the guest of honor instead of the main course. So they're fed beforehand, and it's a celebration of compassion for all beings. And, you know, it draws a big crowd and sells out every year. We make over $30,000 from it. So a lot of fundraising, fun events, innovative thinking. People sort of see us as the cool, hip sanctuary because we don't do things in corporate speak. We're very open and conversational. We try to add some humor to it. So I think those are all reasons for our success.
I'm glad that you mentioned your goal of the year operating budget, because I wonder to what extent the apparent success, because like you say, you're seen as this hip, cool sanctuary. You have incredible celebrity endorsement. You know, all these famous people, Paul McCartney emailed you. And I think a lot of people might get to a point where they think you're too big to fail and that they don't need you anymore.
No. Our operating budget is around $600,000 a year at this point. We have a staff of 10. We really rely on volunteers. You know, we have to do an end of year matching fund drive. There's a donor that gives to us, you know, sometimes $75,000 to $100,000, and he challenges us to have that met by our supporters. These celebrities don't give money. They basically donate their time and talent to your cause. But we have never actually received a check from any one of these celebrities. That's just how it works. And so, no, I mean, we are professionals, both my husband and I. Again, he's worked in film and television for years and years. He's not doing it anymore. I worked as a production coordinator, a production manager, all the way up to associate producing and producing. And we've just had a lot of time to hone some good organizational skills. And again, I think it's just having to be bold, make those connections and say, hey, do you think they'd be willing to do a concert benefit? I hear such and such is vegan and they're attracted to our location also, you know. So again, it's all strategic thinking and we fail. We're not perfect, you know. I mean, we've gotten into major panic mode in terms of funding, but we can't wait till we get to a point where it's not reactive budget meeting. It's proactive. But we do. As we grow, our operating budget grows, and we have to identify those funding sources. Having an active board that helps you do that, and that's very hard to maintain. Everybody would like the board title at the end of their name, but the fundraising part and the time that's involved in it, it's really hard to find those people that are willing to commit.
So can you tell us a little bit about Doug? It seems that with you being almost the front person and with your new book coming out, that Doug is sort of this unsung hero. So can you tell us a little about
him? Oh, he's very much the unsung hero. You know, Doug was always a shy guy in school, and he's one of these people that he doesn't want to be the face of the organization. He feels like I do it better than him. But believe me, in terms of what makes this sanctuary happen on a day-to-day basis, this place would shut down if Doug were to, truly, if something were to happen. I mean, it just so happens that we're very much in love and we're best friends, and that's wonderful. But I try to bring attention to him. He doesn't want to be a face of the sanctuary. It's an uncomfortable position for him. So he encourages me to be it. He's just a guy without an ego, basically. But he's known and respected amongst our supporters and community as the co-founder. And truly, I couldn't make this place happen without him. It was my idea, but, you know, it was his savings that was the deposit for this house. It's his ingenuity and his business savvy, his technical abilities. He's very savvy when it comes to computers and sort of systems administration. I'm the fundraiser. I'm the face. I'm the charmer as much as I can. And I'm the one that trained the staff with the animal care experience that I learned. Infrastructure, administrative infrastructure, Doug's behind everything, truly.
Returning to the budget again, I have a couple of questions to ask you. The first one is, especially when that first animal came through your door and knowing that you didn't have a year's operating budget, was that absolutely terrifying? And does it continue to be terrifying? Because for me, that would be so frightening, having all these lives depending on me.
I know. So it's a constant, stressful effort. But we started, you know, everything that you see out on the grounds of the sanctuary was not there when we bought the place in 2004. It was a house that had some problems, and it was a giant open hayfield, and we watched the price drop and drop and drop, because half the population of Woodstock are second home New Yorkers. Nobody wanted to live in a fishbowl with this house with no landscaping and a giant open hayfield. We began very simply with a small coop, and well, I tell you, part of the reason that we're the size that we are is my relationship to Farm Sanctuary. Within the first 2 years of opening our doors, two sanctuaries closed theirs. And who do they go to? They go to Farm Sanctuary and say, can you help us? Can you take in these older, these bonded pigs? And in the other situation, goats and sheep. So we had our pig barn funded by Wilderness Ranch in Colorado that was open for 10 years, closed their doors. Can you take these middle-aged bonded pigs? Sure, as long as you help us with your existing donors, put up a fence and a barn. Let's be smart about it. Let's install auto waterers. Let's run those electric and plumbing lines. All that information I learned at Farm Sanctuary. Let's do it right the first time. So basically, Wilderness Ranch funded it. And we took their pigs and their rescued pigs. And then the next year, Umani Sanctuary that was in Pennsylvania closed. They were one of the biggest. But the co-founder had a trust fund, and when they got to that point where they needed to become a nonprofit and rely on the public, everything changed. They also started a family. You know, Doug and I have made the decision. It's like we couldn't be parents to children and parents to over 200 rescued from us. This is very full-time work, daily, and we go weeks without getting a day off. And so it is a huge commitment. And for those who would like to have a family, I mean, it's almost the impossible to me. But that's my experience and my opinion. So Umani Sanctuary ended up funding the goat and sheep barn. And we strategized, okay, we need hay storage because we need to minimize the number of buildings we put on the property. We're going to be able to store 1,000 hay bales upstairs. We're going to do this right. We're going to install auto waters. We're going to run electric. We're going to do things right. And again, I don't know how people go about starting an animal sanctuary without having worked at one. If you're going to do it right, and if you're going to give those animals the best care that they deserve. You know, we just had a rooster that had a broken leg and we spent over $1,000 on him. His life matters just as much as your precious companion animals, dogs or cats. We live our values here, and we're all on a level playing field. Those chickens and turkeys matter just as much as somebody's precious prize-winning horse. It's all in human perception of which animals we love and dote over and pay medical bills and which animals we eat. Those lines are gone here. And so we make sure that we have the funding to do everything we can to improve an animal's quality of life if we can. Believe me, we have to make a lot of tough decisions about euthanizing animals who are suffering. But to start a sanctuary and not have the money to properly care for your animals, I think does a real disservice to the animals and to the cause. And so that's a big part of, you know, we're known as having really quality animal care. Again, a lot of it comes from my experience of having worked elsewhere from the best, basically, Farm Sanctuary, who's been doing this for so long, and to really know how to do it right.
So we just have to stop for a couple of minutes to do a quick station identification. We will be right back with Jenny Brown of the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary.
That fun song you just heard is called Cupcakes by Ken Kesey, who was actually a friend of mine. We met a few years ago when we were both living in Portland, Oregon. Since then, I've been promoting his work on the vegan hip-hop movement on MySpace, and as you may have heard, he's reciprocated with a shout-out to the vegan hip-hop movement.
Welcome back to Animal Voices. We again are talking to Jenny Brown of the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary. Jenny, a minute ago you were telling me about the standard of animal care at the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, and that is an interesting segue into one of the questions that's very important to me. I want you to tell me about how you say no and how you resist the urge to, as they say, quote unquote, take them all. And sort of on a related note, I personally generally will not donate to a sanctuary until I've seen it with my own eyes, because so many people who like to call themselves sanctuaries are really sort of straddling the border between sanctuary and hoarding situation.
I totally
agree.
And
I think that the public a lot of the time is not able to recognize good animal care from bad animal care. So talk to me about that a bit.
Well, that's something that always horrifies me. And again, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I worked at a good sanctuary and understood how much work and time and energy is involved in giving the animals that live here, that have come through our doors and that will probably be here for the rest of their life, you know, to be responsible to them. And we have a small sanctuary compared to others, but it's basically in such a great location that we feel like we're helping many other animals by being their voice on our educational tours. We get calls and emails pretty much every day to take in animals. Some of them are across the country. Some of them are surrenders. I don't want this animal anymore. You know, can you take them in? We typically do not take in surrenders. There's been a couple of cases where we've had to. We also know our maximum in terms of comfort, say with our pigs. Having 16 giant farm pigs, we don't take in pot bellies, is really the max. Having about 20 goats, having about 12 to 14 sheep, that's all our pasture can sustain, or we're doing major damage to the land and we'll never get rid of parasites. You need to rotate your pastures. There's a number of things you need to know. But budgetarily, we also know, and staff-wise, with a number of special needs animals that we're dealing with, or hospice for some animals, we know our limitations. We know how much room we have, but we have somebody on staff and we're thrilled to have this resource where basically she answers the phone calls. She has a list of potential adopters, which is a short list, a list of sanctuaries across the country, and resources for those animals that we can't take. We don't take in horses. We have a single mule here right now, and that's a very unusual situation, but it was a desperate situation. And of course, I went over there and saw this animal with a terrible infected eye. So we've taken her in because I knew she lived with goats before. But there's so few places that can take in 800, 900 pound pigs. So we have to say no all the time. And we know that that decision can lead to the ultimate death of those animals, but we have to be responsible to the animals that are here. And we do our best to find other resources to help those animals we're not able to take. It's heartbreaking. And it's very time consuming because lots of us become obsessed with helping that flock of sheep that's going to be slaughtered at the now defunct monastery or whatever, or they're coming from a starvation case. We just took 4 sheep in that came from a terrible starvation case. And as animals pass on in their old age, and again, a number of our animals here, for a long time, we had some very elderly animals because of this situation with taking in existing animals from 2 sanctuaries, that a lot of the animals for a long time were in hospice. It's like, okay, you know, they're 12, 13, 14 years old for some of our sheep out there. They have arthritis. They can still stand up and walk around. They still eat, but we give them pain medication, have to separate them for grain daily. We do liniment rubs on their legs, sometimes have cortisone injections. We have 3 goats out there that have goat diseases that give them painful arthritis. We do acupuncture for them. Again, we strive to do just how you would a passionate animal lover, how you would take care of your beloved companion animals, we do the same for these animals. We know our limitations, and there's a huge responsibility that comes with that, because I've been to some sanctuaries that are, well, one sanctuary in particular, too, that are loved and supported, but people don't go to the properties and see with my eyes the same issues. And it can be really sad. And I do my best to reach out to others without feeling like I'm stepping on toes. But again, I just don't see how people could start this up without constantly being in contact with the good sanctuaries, doing an internship at a good sanctuary, really understanding the responsibility, financial, physical, time-wise, health-wise, and jump into starting a sanctuary. It would be the impossible for me. I really had to understand what I was getting myself into. I had a whole career before this. It was critical as a responsible person and as someone who truly wants to do the best for every animal that comes through our door to be set up in a way and to be empowered with the knowledge that allowed us to do that.
So what would you say to just the average person that is looking at donating to a sanctuary? Of course, you want them to donate to you, but say there's people, for example, in Canada, there's tax issues, so people in Canada might want to donate to a Canadian sanctuary because then they get their tax break, right? So what would you say to people that are saying, you know, I want to donate to a farm animal sanctuary, what do I look for? How do I know that I'm not essentially donating to somebody that's hoarding animals or that's not treating their animals well?
Well, you should go there yourself and look with a critical eye. But again, I realize that the general public is not seeing overgrown hooves, animals like goats with diseases such as caseous lymphonitis, a disease, a virus that attacks their lymph nodes. If I saw an animal with an open abscess on a lymph node and they're in with well animals, that is a problem. I have just seen some things, overgrown hooves that have crippled knees, emaciated animals. You should ask about it. Do they have a disease or something that's causing that? Or are they not treating them for parasites? Look to see if they've got well-documented medical records. Look at their taxes for the last year. Ask to see if they've got a functioning board of directors. Are they being financially responsible? How much money are they bringing in? Those are the kind of things to look for. Is the water clean? Do the animals have food and shelter? Are the shelters clean? Are they living in their own filth? Do they have shade? Do they have enough room to walk around? For a real quality of life and not being kept in a 12 by 12 pen. Ask yourself, basically, if you're walking through an animal sanctuary, is this how I would like to live? With others of your kind, in good health, well fed, with plenty of room to roam and shelter. Those are the kind of things you look for.
Now, turning back to the issue of having to say no, I want to talk to you a bit about this sort of strange situation that farm sanctuaries face. And I think that Dylan is probably a prime example. He's one of your steers. Now, somebody, I think, bought him from a farmer and then he was brought here. But sanctuaries generally don't do that. They generally will not buy an animal to rescue him. The idea is that you're supporting, therefore, the meat industry and they're just going to be replaced with another
Absolutely.
Animal.
Absolutely. We are adamant about telling the public that we cannot go out and buy animals at auctions and why we don't support the system and how many other animals that are out there in need. What has happened in a number of cases is that very well-intentioned people have taken it upon themselves. In the case of little Dylan, he was at a dairy farm, just a small calf, tied to a tree. They had to go and investigate what was going on. And they were basically told outright that a veal farmer was scheduled to pick him up that day. And they couldn't help themselves. And I do understand this. He became an individual to them. He looked them in the eyes. They see this tiny calf that's desperately trying to suckle on fingers. And they bought him for maybe $80 or something, and then they took him home. And then we got the phone call. If somebody's interested and tells us about a situation and says, look, I know they're going to go to auction and I'm prepared to buy them from this person, I say, You shouldn't tell us that. We do not support that. If we allowed that, then people would be knocking down our door every day, and we only have so much space. And so we not only don't encourage it, we say we will not. But of course, in some situations, people have gotten in over their head, you know, well-intentioned people, and they saved them. You know, and if I was one of those animals going through an auction ring, you know, I wouldn't care how somebody got me out of there. But to be responsible, to not support the system, to have the quality care and the resources for the animals that are also coming out of dangerous situations, desperate situations, we have to say no. It's part of the job, and it sucks just as much as losing these precious animals when it's time for them to go. This is the reality of it, and we're emotional, passionate people. Every animal that we lose is like losing your beloved companion animal. I don't say pet. So that's the reality of it, and some people emotionally also can't handle that.
Now, in your book, you do refer to some of your animals coming from factory farms, but there's also a lot of them that are coming from small-scale farms. And small-scale farms, as we know, are now being sort of touted as a more humane alternative to the factory farm. Now, I grew up in a community of small farms, so I know firsthand the abuses that animals in these situations suffer. And a lot of times, it's at the hands of very good people who simply don't know any better. And this is why the move to allow, for example, backyard chickens, that's a big thing going on in Ottawa, where I live right now, that really scares me. Can you speak from your experience about this idea that when it comes to farming, small equals humane?
Yeah, and I talk a lot about that in the book, which, by the way, is called The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals, and it just came out. And it chronicles the story of my life with a lot of this information about the myths of humane agriculture. First of all, the term humane slaughter is an oxymoron. It's basically saying humane murder, humane killing. Those two words should never go together. Also, what people realize, especially starting with this backyard farming movement, what people don't realize is that these people are mail ordering chicks from these large hatcheries that have catalogs, and you can pick out whatever kind of breed you want and the productive egg layers or the birds that are like Frankenbirds that grow to market weight at 45 days of age. It depends on where your feelings and your idea of what is humane. But again, in the example of chickens, all these tiny chicks are mail ordered for small farms alike, and at the hatcheries for the egg-laying breeds, the males are skinny little worthless animals to them because they're in this country and pretty much around the world in Western civilization, there are birds that are used commercially for egg-laying, there are birds that are used commercially for meat, and there's very little crossover. So the productive layers from the hatcheries, they sort out all the males and they're ground up alive or they're put into large plastic bags. And when they're full, they're tied up. Also, a lot of those chicks are de-beaked because they're not determining if they're going to go to a small farm or to a factory farm. They're expected to be crowded no matter where they live. And so often at about 10 days old, the females have their beaks seared off with a hot guillotine blade or pressed up against a molten hot surface so that the tips of their beaks become round, not pointed. If they're packed in together, they're not going to peck or cannibalize one another. So these chicks never meet their mother. They're mail ordered. They're literally shipped through the mail. You know, the hatcheries say, don't worry about counting the dead ones. We'll replace them. And when their production declines, they're usually sent off to slaughter as well. Well, let's rephrase that. They're always sent off to slaughter unless it's somebody they've mail ordered for chickens and they're eating their eggs. Perhaps they're going to let them live for the rest of their lives, but they're certainly not going to be most people take them to the vet and love them and care for them and have the knowledge about how to treat their parasites and external lice and things like that. But in the end, anybody that's doing it for profit, there is no retirement home for the spent layers when their production declines. They all become the cheap chicken meat that's in soups, dog and cat food, that sort of thing. So is that humane? Look at what happens before they even come to these small farmers. The fact that they're grinding up alive all the males. Are you okay with that? I'm not. In terms of like free range pigs, they're still castrated without anesthesia. Their tails are cut off without anesthesia. Oftentimes for the males, their incisor teeth are pulled. Their ears are notched. This is all without painkillers or anesthesia. Is that humane to you? The last example, organic milk or beef from grass-fed animals. Still, these are animals that are not being pampered, given pain meds and anesthesia when they're castrated, in the example of beef cows, and they're branded. They're often dehorned. For dairy cows, no matter what, for any farm that's producing milk that's in the business of the dairy industry, they impregnate those cows by artificial insemination year after year. And just like in the chicken industry, there are breeds we use for milk production and there are breeds we use for beef, and there's very little crossover. So when dairy cows, when they're about 13 months old, they're artificially inseminated and their gestation period is like ours. It's 9 months. And year after year, she has her calves taken away from her, typically within a day or two of birth. And these animals are not automatrons. They cry and they bellow and their hearts are broken and they'll bellow for days looking aimlessly for their calves. So is that humane? I don't think so. And at 5 years of age, instead of living to 20 or 25 years old, dairy cows are forced to produce 10 times more milk than they would have in nature, often through growth hormones, but also through the constant pregnancy and being milked during pregnancy and the toll that takes on their bodies. And at about 4 or 5 years of age, typically the calcium's been leached from her bones. They get very brittle bones. 65% of dairy cows suffer from painful mastitis, which is an infection in their breast. And in the end, you know, 85% of the ground beef or hamburger meat is made from the spent bodies of dairy cows. So look into it. A lot of people think that cows just magically produce milk, but just as any mother, they have maternal instincts and nurturing, and calves will stay with their mothers for years and years, maybe the rest of their life if they're allowed to. There's a maternal bond there. Siblings want to be together. Take, for instance, Judy and Patsy, the pigs out there. They're inseparable. They have familial ties. They recognize their families. They recognize their friends. Are you okay with that? Would you be okay with pulling puppies away from a mama dog at a day of age? But then really look at the big picture. Humans are the only species that drinks milk into adulthood. We're the only species that drinks the mammary secretions of another species. Why don't we drink kangaroo milk or rat milk or dog milk? Because cows produce a lot of milk and they're easily controlled. And that's sort of what our bankrupt society, our bankrupt humanity looks to do.
So tell me about what made you decide to write the book. The book, again, is called
The Lucky Ones. And it's about the lucky ones who come through our doors. It's about me feeling like a lucky one because I overcame cancer as a child and lost my leg to cancer. So it was my story of overcoming adversity. What really made me want to write the book is to tell the stories of these amazing animals who have touched our hearts, who have opened hearts and minds, who are the ambassadors to our cause here, but also to raise awareness about what's happening in industrialized agriculture and to dispel some myths of misleading animal labels such as organic, such as free range, such as cage free, but also telling it through my personal story. I didn't come from, you know, tree hugging, hippie, vegetarian parents. I came from a poor, conservative, Southern Baptist family that ate meat at every meal, meat, cheese, milk, or eggs at every meal. I didn't come from a place of being raised as a vegetarian child and being aware of all these things. I said I loved animals, but I wasn't including all animals in that statement. And I think if we want to live our values, if we say we're against animal cruelty, then we have to take a look at how we treat these animals. And the message is also, shouldn't we be evolving into a species that doesn't feast off the bodies of tortured animals? We are animals. We no longer have the need for meat. And if we can live happily and healthily without inflicting violence or harm or taking the lives of others, why wouldn't we simply make that choice?
Now, I want to say I read your book, and it is incredibly passionate and incredibly informative, but it's also incredibly fun. Like, I had many instances where I was laughing out loud. I'll just give the audience one example where you say, I still bought my clothes at a discount store called Fashion Shop and had only recently quit wearing my hair as big as it could get. Yeah. So it's really fun, and it's written in a really sort of conversational and really, really unpretentious style. And I wonder, is that just you being you, or was that deliberate because you were trying to pull in an audience that maybe thinks of vegans as snobs?
Well, I had a friend who's also an animal activist that was my co-writer that really helped me nail out the structure. And it's very conversational. It's just sort of the way I talk. You know, all of us vegans are not angry, you know, fist-punching, angry animal rights activist. I'm very hurt by what's happening. And I'm very sensitive to suffering, I think, because of my childhood of suffering with, you know, almost 3 years of chemotherapy and losing my leg and feeling alienated from the rest of the world. It made me very sensitive. But one thing I learned as a new vegetarian at 18 years old, that was a soapbox preaching, fist pumping, angry animal rights activist, it's not an effective way to be. And to me, it's all about being informative, to relate to people and say that you came from the same place of unawareness, but to share with people what I've learned and to try to raise awareness so that we begin to bridge that gap in our consciousness and to make the invisible visible. And these videos, wonderful groups like Mercy for Animals, getting into these places, acquiring jobs, animal-loving people, acquiring jobs at slaughterhouses and at factory farms, they are our eyes into these places. And terrible things are happening right now in terms of ag-gag legislation that makes it a criminal offense to obtain a job at one of these places under false pretenses. It's already passed in several states in the U.S. We've got to fight these measures because, you know, as Linda McCartney said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, there'd be a lot more vegetarians. And so it's just hopefully a vehicle to raising awareness, to bridging that gap in our consciousness, to making people aware, to draw people to animal sanctuaries. You know, great, come to Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary and support our work, but go and meet a commercial pig, meet a rescued veal calf who's now a happy 2,000-pound steer, cuddle a chicken, get to know animals that are socialized and happy and have lost their fear of humans in an environment where they're treated as individuals and not as production units or as commodities because they behave very differently. Open your mind and heart to the plight of these animals. And that's all I want to do.
And I've got to say, Neil and I did a little bit of volunteer work last night because we were staying over at the guest house. And I, as I said, grew up on a hobby farm. So I met a lot of animals. I'd known horses and cows and chickens. But one animal that I'd never interacted with was turkeys. And yesterday I had the best time because I was cleaning out the pig buckets. And these two turkeys were on like either side of my shoulder the whole time, just like kissing distance to me, just watching every move that I was making. And I just couldn't get over how sociable they were and how unafraid and how intrigued they were by, you know, the activity that I was involved in. It was really great. So
they're so friendly. They're such amazing ambassadors. They've lost their fear of humans. They seek out your affection and attention. Timmy out there, all he wants to do is show off for you. And that, you know, I hug him and I kiss him, and Beatrice lays on my lap if I'm out there, likes to tuck her head under my arms. They're incredibly intelligent and sentient beings. And if people would just give them the chance, you know, maybe they would begin to see them as something different than hot wings and turkey sandwiches and the centerpiece for Thanksgiving here in America. That's why we've turned it into Thanksgiving, putting our own spin on it, and taking the centerpiece of a dead, tortured animal off the table.
Neil and I actually were at the Thanksgiving celebration last year, and it was great, and we hope to come back this year. It was
cool.
Really, really awesome, and the desserts were insane. I think I filled up my entire year's caloric load from those desserts. They were so good.
Vegan Treats is
yes,
also
vegan
doing
treats.
It again
peanut
this year.
Peanut butter bomb, that's all I gotta say.
People, is the bomb.
Bomb.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's everybody's favorite.
Peanut butter bomb is the bomb.
Yeah, it's so good. Now, just returning to the book for a couple of seconds, I understand your idea that you need to move away from the sort of bitter proselytizer, quote unquote, which is what you said you used to be in the book, but you also don't pull a lot of punches in the book. And one thing that particularly resonated with me, because it bugs me, is this notion that sacrifice is like this four-letter word that, no, like, what do you mean? I have to sacrifice. And veganism has kind of moved that way, saying, look, you don't have to eat meat because there's all these alternatives, or you don't have to eat dairy because there's all these alternatives, as if the alternatives weren't there, it would be okay, you know? And I appreciate the fact that you're like, you know what? There are all these alternatives and that's great. But even if there weren't, too bad. Suck it up, people. You know, you're eating something tasty is not worth their lives. So I really appreciated that.
Absolutely. Because ultimately, you know, as it says right here on one of our shirts, I believe animals are here with us and not for us. And use that as a baseline. I'm not just against factory farms. I'm against farming sentient emotional beings. We can move past that. And for our morality and for our environment and sustainability and our health, we have to move beyond that. Let's evolve. Forget what we've always done, because we've always murdered, we've always raped, we've always abused children. Is that a good enough reason to keep on doing it? You know, let's evolve. Let's have compassion for all beings.
And speaking of, I think that you are needing to go out and give your tour, because the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary gives tours on Saturdays.
We're opening right now, yeah,
okay,
but we start tours at about 11:30.
Okay, so before we go, can you just tell people how they can help, about maybe how they can visit, just whatever you want to say before you leave?
Oh, well, great. Well, hopefully people will pick up my new book, The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals, available via our website or all major retailers. Come visit us. We're open from April through October on the weekends. We now have a bed and breakfast, which you guys just enjoyed, where you get a vegan meal and you can walk out and pet some very happy animals without feeling guilty. And take a look into this world. You know, we're in this little bubble here where all of us that work here who thrive on a plant-based diet, come learn about it and meet these animals and ask yourself, if you weren't willing to look an animal in the eyes and slaughter him or her, why do you pay somebody else to do the dirty work? Be a voice for farm animals. Look into it. Don't turn a blind eye. As Gretchen Weiler said, and as I quote in this book, and she was an actress and an animal advocate, and she said, we must not refuse to see with our eyes what they must endure with their bodies. And so I think we have an obligation to look at what our consumer dollars support. Educate yourself. Meet a chicken and a pig and a cow and a turkey living happily. and ask yourself if you're living your values. On another note, you can also support our good work by making a donation, by sponsoring an animal here, and by supporting your local sanctuaries. Check them out first. Go visit a sanctuary. Bring others to a sanctuary. And live your values. You can learn more about animal agriculture and the work that we do here by going to woodstocksanctuary.org. And again, I hope your listeners will pick up the book, The Lucky Ones. And if you're ever in New York, come visit the beautiful Catskill Mountains and this little funky town of Woodstock. Come out and visit us. It's well worth the trip. There's other activities to do around here, wineries, good food, a fabulous vegan restaurant in town. Just dive into this culture a little bit. Be a part of it. Many people are shifting to a vegetarian or a vegan diet. Learn what it's all about and why. And stop eating animals.
And on that note, I will just thank Jenny for coming on the show. And I also wanted to mention that we are doing a little promotion this week. We've got 2 signed copies of Jenny's book, The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals. We're going to be posting an announcement on Facebook for this show before it airs and also when it's available for podcast. So if you share it on your Facebook page, we will enter you into a draw to win one of the copies. Now you have to share it right from the Animal Voices page because that's the only way we can track you. And also, people outside of North America, please be forewarned. If you win, it'll probably take a couple of months to reach you, as I am way too cheap to pay for express delivery. So on that note, thanks everybody for listening. Animal Voices is produced from CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines and broadcast since 1996 on CIUT 89.5 FM, University of Toronto's community radio station. You can also listen to Animal Voices on iTunes Radio under the College University category, Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, or online at ciut.fm. You can also access our archive of well over 300 shows online at animalvoices.ca. Please spread the word also about Animal Voices by liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter, and checking us out on Tumblr. And if you like a specific show, please do share it far and wide. Remember, everybody, the world is vegan if you want it. So do spread the word. Thank you very much to the whole Animal Voices team, including Catherine Brigantino, Daniel Angrenon, Taylor Book, Marilyn Matavia, and Matthew Barton. And also a special thanks to my dear partner and today's tech guy, Neil Harvey. To contact the Animal Voices team with comments, questions, or suggestions for show ideas, please email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. I'm Erin O'Sullivan. Thank you for listening. Thanks so much.
That was a freaking mouthful.
Yeah, it was. You have to-